I think BFG is maybe not to as great of an extent, but I think that is a cultural touchstone for a lot of people.
I don't know if it is. I read that story. I don't think that it's. It was like Latter Day Roald Dahl. Yeah. So like, I don't think it had time to like be as much of a classic.
I loved it when it was.
I only liked Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I hated the one with the two idiots. Was that
to be more specific?
The twits.
It was like, I remember it was called like the idiots or the dumb people.
When I was little and I read that. Roald
Dahl presents the dumb people.
When I was little and I read that, I was like, oh my god. I got such a rush off of like judging these obvious morons.
Yeah, and they were just like, it wasn't like we cared about them or wanted them to succeed. No. It was just like, it was like reading Tortilla Flat or something. We're like, you're just watching these like poor unfortunate people that aren't that smart. And then that, like, guess what? Things don't really go out that well for them.
I would love to see, like, a dramatic reinterpretation of the twits. Just, like, watching these two sad, pathetic, miserable people try and live their lives.
Yeah, well, they're not even sad and pathetic because they're just, like, mean and
horrible.
Yeah, I
know, they're awful. Yeah.
I don't know, like, I loved Roald Dahl. I loved James and the Giant Peach. I loved Matilda.
I like Matilda.
I loved.
I think Matilda's a good movie too.
It's a great movie.
Danny DeVito is a really good choice both to star and in direct in it because he really nails the tone of like a terrible world that's also really enjoyable to be in.
Yeah, the trunchbull and the chokey. It's all very
so good.
I would like him to do like another Roald Dahl movie at some point. It'd be a good fit for.
I think they were too whimsical for me.
I love the Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Fantastic Mr. Fox, terrific.
The movie is sort of hit or miss for me.
I love the movie.
I didn't care for the movie, but I don't know.
There are elements in the movie I really like.
You don't like Wes Anderson.
I know. I wanted to like that movie so much.
Animation should be his arena.
Yeah,
he's so detail obsessed.
When we were in elementary school, I remember we read the BFG. Mm-hmm. And my teacher, like, we read it, like, as a class. Like, my teacher read it out loud as we read it along with her. And the first day when we were reading it, she, like, held up the book. And she's like, this book is called The BFG. Does anyone know what this stands for? And I was looking at the cover. And, like, I was further back. So I didn't know, like, what it was. I just saw, like, this, like, enormous guy with, like, some sort of apparatus. Which turns out to be, like, the trombone thing that he blows dreams of people.
Right.
And I thought it was, like, a rake. And so I raised my hand. I was like, is it the big farmer guy? And she was like...
Oh my god, that's
like,
adorable.
No, it's the big friendly giant. And I was remember thinking, like, well, then why would you ask us this question? Like, I'm far back enough that I couldn't reasonably see what's on this cover.
I like that you were still, like...
indignant.
Yeah, indignant that, like, you got
point
the
question, of order, Mrs. Taurasi.
You got the question wrong, and then you're just like, well, it's your fault.
Yeah, what were you expecting me to say?
Tell us.
I'm done. Hey, podcast listeners, and welcome to another episode of Why Did We Watch This? I am Brendan, the Wrong Wolf, Drishler.
I am Chris, Holographic Dog, Ravel.
I'm Lee Athena, Delahanty.
And we have a special guest for this episode, friend of the podcast and friend of ours. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Brendan, the Right Wolf, Nystead.
That's a nice bit of symmetry. We've got two Brendans in this episode.
And they're both wolves.
That's right. So good luck telling us apart, fuckers. So our episode today was 2015's Tomorrowland. And for Tomorrowland, we had two, possibly three drinks. Chris, would you like to recap what those drinks were for
us? I would love to. So we basically, the two main drinks we had were the Pessimist, which is your average old-fashioned. It's a whiskey-based drink. A little bit of bitters, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of water. It's really, really tasty. It's a very classic drink. It is a little bit more kind of on the bitter side, which is why we have also the Optimist, which was a very, more or less the same drink, just with gin and rhubarb or grapefruit bitters instead. And because we have a non-drinker among us, the right wolf over there, we made a virgin version of the gin cocktail called the Nihilist, which was... really just club soda, rhubarb bitters, and a little, just a splash of simple syrup.
What did you guys think of drinks?
Delish.
Tasty.
I had the gin one, which I was okay with.
Yeah, I liked mine too.
Yeah.
It was,
honestly,
rave reviews as always from Lee Delahanty.
Honestly, like, I picked up my favorite Old Tom sweetened gin, which I use for my other drinks, and I'd forgotten that it was in my car, and I had, like, a little bit of it early today when I brought it up, and, like... I just love that
gin. It's delish.
And it's not like you did a lot to that gin to make that drink. You just added some, like, water, like, club soda. And
it was a pretty straightforward drink.
And my other drink with that is, like, a Remsen Cool, where you just add club soda and a hint of lemon. That's just the gin that just tastes so great.
I was going to say, would you like...
It says on the bottle.
It's just the gin that tastes so
good. I was going to say, would you like to plug it officially? Old Tom's Gin?
Yeah.
Save it for the commercial break.
You can find Old Tom's Gin. Get your hands on it.
We drank the whiskey version, which I also thought was quite nice. We made it with Seagram's, and it was actually pretty piney and delicious.
Yeah, no, it was. I'm not a huge whiskey person in general, but I did enjoy it. It was a pretty straightforward drink, more so than we usually do, I think. We usually go kind of nuts. This was pretty simple.
It was more chilled out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made us think of all those nostalgic times of the past, which seemed only fitting for this picture.
Those halcyon days.
Speaking of this picture, Chris, would you like to give us a little bit of a recap before we get into it?
So Tomorrowland, the story that starts with George Clooney as Frank, who, as a very young child visiting the World's Fair in 1964, he has created a prototype of an almost working jetpack that he presents to Nix, played by Hugh Laurie, who is, I guess, pretending to be a part of the World's Fair. And the robot Athena, who looks like a very young girl, played by Raffi Cassidy.
We don't know she's a robot yet.
We don't know she's a robot yet, but we find that out. Essentially, through convoluted means, slips him a pin to gain him entry into Tomorrowland when Nix is sort of like poo-pooing his jetpack idea. He kind of flies around Tomorrowland, gets accepted into the fold, and then we get a second entry into the movie with Casey, played by Britt Robertson, who is a young girl, daughter of an ex-NASA engineer who seems to be a bit of a gearhead herself. She's breaking into government property, she's destroying shit, she's stealing parts. She finds a pin of her own that gains her entry to Tomorrowland after she is discharged by the police when she's caught. So she bounces around trying to figure out what the mechanics of the pin are. Athena finds her, drops her off at George Clooney's place. Their robots attack. They take a flying, rocket pod to New York, which they then drive from there.
Ooh boy.
Yeah.
Ooh, buddy.
To a portal.
No, okay, no, buddy, no. Let's stop. All right, so.
We got this.
Yeah,
I'll
all right,
pick
so
it up.
After.
I'll pick it
okay,
up.
Go. After. Can you cover Houston? Briefly mention Houston. What happens in Houston?
She looks up the pin on the internet, as you do, and it says there's this like shady 1990s website for like this vintage
store. Yeah.
So she's like, oh, okay, they want to know, like, it's like, if you have this pin, come talk to us. So she does, because it acts like, oh, we're going to, like, buy these pins because they're rare. And then she meets, like, what, Catherine Hahn and...
Keegan-Michael Key
are, like, the store owners, and they're, like, drilling her about, like, where she found this pet, like, where she found this pin.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, oh, the little girl gave it to you, did you see shit? And when she explains correctly that did not happen, that she just found this pin, they're like, that's, you're lying, and they try to, like, shoot her.
With laser guns.
Yeah, and then Athena basically comes to save the day, and it turns out that Keegan-Michael Key and Catherine Hahn are robots.
Yep.
And that this is some sort of, like, honey trap for like people that have Tomorrowland pins. So then Athena takes her to Frank's house.
Yeah.
Where she they then from Frank's house take a bathtub that launches them into a river.
Mm-hmm.
During another robot attack.
Athena comes to pick them up. They all three go to, I forget where they go first.
It's elsewhere in New York.
In New York, where they have to take some sort of dimensional portal thing that leads them to the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
Inside the Eiffel Tower, in which they board a rocket that blasts out of the Eiffel Tower with everyone watching.
Right, that splits the Eiffel Tower in twain as a rocket comes out of the ground underneath, rides up that shaft.
And sends out an EMP, destroying all electronics
in
the area.
Right, so suck on that, Paris.
So, from there, that sort of, when it comes back down, it sort of re-enters the atmosphere and also changes dimensions and into Tomorrowland, which is a pretty cool sequence.
Yeah.
Which, despite what we've already seen from earlier in the movie, what we saw earlier in the movie and what we saw from Casey's pin was this very idealized, retrofuturistic beauty town. But what we see is this kind of torn up, like, post-apocalyptic
dystopian.
Do
you want to take it up again, or do you want me to do it?
Oh, I think I can get it from there.
Because you keep
we'll be watching
me.
Well, I was trying to show I can do this.
Oh,
I'm not a total lucky.
Baby gets to narrate.
Actually, no, just continue. I don't know. All right. This.
Yeah, they arrive in the spaceport, which, unlike the beautiful version we saw earlier, it's like some sort of like shithole. Like, it's like all dirty and run down. Governor Nix and some guards quickly show up. That's like the first 15 people and the last 15 people that you ever see in Tomorrowland.
It's so true.
And, you know, they have this confrontation, and Frank basically says that, oh, I think that Casey can, like, change things. And then it's revealed that, like, they've created this machine called the Monitor that can, like, see into the past and the future. And that the future is, like, basically everything. The world is just, like,
in about 66 days or something.
Yeah, 58 days. Yeah. It's, like, a grab bag apocalypse of, like, war, flooding.
In all possible ways.
Yeah, yeah, like, everything goes to hell. Everything
that can go wrong does go wrong. Yeah. Murphy's apocalypse.
Yeah, depending on where you are, tune in to see what sort of apocalypse awaits you. Like, it could be government overthrow, could be a flood, we don't know. But then, basically, when she's in it, she has this, like, moment of, like, well, what if that's not the case? And then there's, like, a flicker of a beautiful utopia. It's the idea that, you know, there's a possibility that, like, she has the ability to change things somehow. But when Nick sees that, he instantly just, like, says...
Shuts it down.
Nope! And knocks them all out, and then is prepared to, like, banish them back to Earth for, like, the remaining 58 days. However, when Casey wakes up with Frank, and she basically has this idea that, like, if Frank was able to pirate the sort of deadly future scenario signal on Earth in his little doomsday room, that maybe everyone else could be picking it up, and maybe they're, like, getting all depressed about the idea of, this apocalypse, and that's why they're all just accepting it, and that's why, like, the world is doomed. So she says, well, what if we could, you know, shut it down, or at least present, like, a more optimistic future? So they go present this idea to Nix, and Nix pretty much says, no, I know that we're broadcasting the doomsday signal. That was my idea, but you know what? It just really goes to show you that you guys don't care, and that's why you're all doomed, basically. And he refuses to even try shutting it down, basically, and is prepared to throw them out. So, like, cue action sequence where, well, you know, they're trying to get... They send Frank out first. They have this fight where Athena starts wrestling these two big robots.
Mm-hmm. Casey has a detonation
device. Yeah, Frank throws Casey, like, the one kiloton detonation bomb, and she's trying to get up to the monitor, but they're having, like, a fight with the elevator button as well. So it's, you know, this convoluted action sequence of, like, fight in and out of, like, a dimensional portal, mm-hmm. her going up and down periodically to get into the monitor, and then Athena doing, like, a real-life Rock'em Sock'em robot fight with one of those big, like, support robots.
The platform that Casey's on crashes back to the ground.
Yeah, that's what I was
Athena
saying.
Athena stops elevator. It by using the robot to catch it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's smashed, it's ruined.
So they can't get back up there.
Yeah, so what also happens, though, is Athena dives in front of Frank to save him from being shot by Nix, which, you know, it's
well, they lose the bomb first.
Right. They lose the bomb, they don't have enough time, so they throw it out of the portal.
Mm-hmm.
It blows up. Nix is trapped underneath a piece of debris.
Yeah.
Athena basically says that it's, you know, whatever the robot equivalent of a mortal wound is, I'm going to die. But I have a self-destruct initiative, as our robots do. So if you take me up, we'll activate the self-destruct sequence. You can put me in the monitor and I will blow it up.
Yeah.
And so Frank carries her up in a jetpack. And they have, like, a little touching scene where they sort of talk about how they, you know, they used to be friends and they weren't so much anymore, but they have a certain understanding and, like, you know, there's a love between these two characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then he drops her. She goes into the monitor. As she self-destructs, the monitor crashes back to the ground. It flattens Nix. There's another EMP that knocks out the electricity in Tomorrowland.
We don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, just crashing electricity seems to have a lot of, like, EMP things in this movie.
Yeah.
So Casey and Frank meet up again, and they're just sort of like, well, what do we do now? We've got to, you know, we've got to get more people in Tomorrowland. We've got to have some engineers and some smart people. So they bring Casey's dad in, they bring her little brother in, and they set out with a whole bunch of new child robots to recruit people using the pins that they had earlier on. And then we end with a nice little montage of these robots going around to, like, different artists and engineers and conservationists and teachers and leaving these pins for them. And then the last shot is all these people in the fields outside Tomorrowland.
Took three people to explain it.
Yeah.
So initial thoughts on the movie.
We didn't need two openings.
Right. So why don't we start off with the whole sort of two openings?
Let's talk. I think we should compare and contrast with a movie that does dual protagonists a lot much better, which is Jack the Giant Slayer.
Okay.
Where it starts with the telling of the fairy tale, and it very smoothly, within 10 minutes, sort of cuts back. Well, not even 10. It's like 5 minutes.
It's a shorter sequence.
It's just like the introduction to these two characters, and very smoothly cuts back and forth between, like, her hearing the story and little Jack hearing the story, and, like, you're introduced to, like, okay, these are the two characters they're going to be the most important in the story. And I feel like that might have been what they were trying to go for in Tomorrowland, to some extent, where they have these two characters who are meant to work together. And yet, what we do is we get to see one for, like, 10 minutes, and then another one for, like, 10 minutes, and then, like, 10, and then, like, sort of 50 minutes of, like, her getting to him, and then it's the rest of them. It's just like a bad structure to introduce these two characters.
Yeah. And also, just to note real quick, there is a framing device.
Yes, which makes it even more confusing.
Right, where we see it's George Clooney talking to the camera, and every now and then Casey will interject and say things.
Oh, yeah.
Before she gets her time.
Right, so she basically says, like, start telling people, like, what the deal is. And he's like, well, let me tell you about the future. Let me tell you about when I was a boy and I went to the World's Fair, blah, blah, blah. And then Casey's like, this is very upsetting. I'm going to tell the story now instead. So, like, it's like they had to sort of cover the fact that they had these two disjointed opening sequences by adding this framing device.
I also hate that framing device.
Oh, yeah, no.
It almost made it more confusing because the not as if either of them VO over their openings or anything. Right. So it doesn't help.
No. And I think the movie thinks that it's a lot cuter than it actually is.
It's not.
No, it's not.
No.
The Frank at the end of the movie would also not be the person he is.
That pessimist,
yeah. Yeah. He's like, everything is so terrible. But that's like the Frank that we meet. That's right. Just the Frank that like introduces the movie to us after it all happened.
Which I guess they put him in that mode out of necessity for that's where the character started, but then that's even more confusing.
Well, it's like aggression.
Yeah.
Right. Aggression for him, which is confusing as hell.
Really, I guess sort of the other issue with the opening is that it puts a lot of emphasis on Frank as a character right off the bat. Mm-hmm. We believe that Frank is going to be this important character we follow around. Mm-hmm. Then we don't. And then we jump into Casey, who we assume then will be the next important character. But the thing is, really, that of the two characters, and it looks like they are trying to go for, like, a dual protagonist thing.
Oh, yeah, but I don't think they did.
No, because Casey doesn't really undergo a journey. Frank does. Casey starts out as a very, like, optimistic, like, a little bit troubled, but still very optimistic sort of problem solver. And she continues to be that person because, like, the movie espouses that is a good thing to be, which, you know, that's true. That is a good thing to be. Frank starts out as a person who, like, as a child was very, like, excited about the future and then became jaded after he was kicked out of Tomorrowland after inventing the monitor. We don't really get the reasoning,
no,
right? Just
we
that he
don't.
Invented the monitor.
I mean, I assume, again, this is assumption.
Yeah.
Because like we see Tomorrowland in the future, we have no idea how it ended up like this or why some of it looks like a shithole now.
Right.
But like and where all the people are.
Well he's been gone for 24 years. He doesn't
right.
even
over yeah 25.
It's also even more bizarre that they don't really elaborate beyond one very vague statement why he was kicked out to begin
with. But
I
think I would imagine my assumption had always been that they invented this thing and that maybe there was disagreement about what to do about it. Like, because, Hawks wanted to clearly... He shut... Sorry,
Nix.
Hawks. General Hawks.
They have similar codes.
Yeah. They have similar codes. Governor Nix basically decided to, like, close borders and, like, not tell Earth that they're fucked and just, like, deal... And just, you know, Tomorrowland's gonna be fine. Maybe Frank was like, no, we should tell Earth or whatever, and then that's why he got kicked out. Again, we don't know. It should be explained. But
it really should
love.
Be.
To have had that explained, even a little bit. They even had a chance when we were kind of given like a montage flashback with that Athena sort of voiceovers on.
They totally skip over that period of time. It goes from being like the 60s when they're kids to being the 80s when he's getting kicked out.
By the way, that final montage of like Athena and Frank, it really should have been like childhood, teen, adult, but it was like
childhood, adult.
Like, it was like three scenes from him at age 12, and then he was suddenly like at age probably like 25 or something.
Yeah, it would have been even more heartbreaking if you saw him grow up and she was the same.
Yeah.
That, like, again, this is another part of the movie that I feel like more time should have been spent on.
Right, well, there's also, like we said, there's a problem in that at some point, Frank finds out that she's a robot, which he did not know at first, but we never see him find out.
No, we never see
that
moment.
We don't know what their relationship is like. We don't know, like, if they stopped being friends for the whole time after that. Like, from, like, you know, presumably, like, at some point in the 60s, Frank was either told... Like, hey, this kid's a robot, or he was like, hey, I'm aging and you're not. What's up with this? And so, like, were they friends from that point until the 80s when he was kicked out? Like, did they hate each other the whole time? Like, was there some sort of, like, awkwardness? But we never find out, like, what their relationship was like.
All we know is
that
in 84 that, like, he said that he lost hope and he blames her for giving it to him.
Yeah.
But also, what a weird scene to not include in this movie. That confrontation of that realization.
He's absolutely still bitter about the thing, about the not-robot thing. Because in the future, he like, is very, like, he's making a lot of, like, taking a lot of pot shots at her, like, programming.
Yeah.
And, like, it's all zeros and ones.
So it would have been nice to have seen any underpinning for that.
Yeah.
Like, it's... Or any underpinning for the acrimony between him and Nix.
Mm.
We get a slight hint of that in that Nix is kind of dismissive of him as a child. But then we just jump forward to a relationship we don't really have any idea of.
To tell you how much I told Brendan how much I hated that line where he sees Nix again. Because he obviously looks the same.
Yeah.
And Nix says, like, I think I'll keep drinking my shake. It comes in chocolate now. Yeah. I hate that line because they have to, like, I don't need you to tell me that you're drinking an aging drink.
The need to explain why Nyx has not aged in the past, like, 30 years. I would have just been okay with just, like, whatever happened, he doesn't age. Like, that's cool.
And why spend your time on explaining details like that that don't matter when you could explain it on, like, things that actually underpin the emotional relationship?
I think it's one of those things that then raises more questions once you hear it, because now I'm like, does everyone drink this shake? Is, like, are you supposed to drink
and
this?
And how long does the shake work for?
Yeah. I will defend the shake a little bit. I've been drinking it every morning. I watched this movie with my girlfriend, and she just assumed, given that Athena was a robot, that he was also a robot since he did not age. So it does explain that away to audience members that maybe didn't pick up on the fact.
The shake thing, though, right, is like, we know that, like, there's an aging gene, and that if you turn it off, we still have a time limit, but, like, we just wouldn't look like
physically
shit.
Right, yeah, I mean, presumably, like, if this is Tomorrowland, maybe they can do, like, organ replacements.
Yeah, but,
so,
like, again, now I have this question.
Yeah.
Like, does the shake work forever, or does it work for, like, 3 years?
Yeah, he says every morning, so, like, if you don't drink it, like, one morning, will he, like, age 200 years or something like that? And Mother Gothel entangled and just, like, crumble into dust.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for Tangled.
Sorry, guys.
I think this is a good segue to the Nyx, to our topic about Governor Nyx as a character and as a villain.
He's not a great villain.
Mm-mm. No. End of topic, moving on.
No. I mean, he's just not. He's not given very much to do. You're not really sure what his plan is.
Yeah.
He gets a great monologue that kind of explains his position a little bit. There's clear logical holes in his reasoning.
I think it's great and not great. I think it's a great monologue and not great.
So what I think is, it's a good monologue, but it's not for his character. Like, it's a good monologue for a philosophy, but it does not seem to be the same philosophy that Governor Nyx is a character.
Well, also, it's like, he's giving this monologue, but he doesn't have the evidence to back that monologue up. He basically, like, is talking about a hypothetical scenario in which you tell someone that they're, like, that, for example, climate change. Like, you give someone a report on climate change, and they're like, okay, we don't believe you. We're just going to keep having emissions because we like emissions. What he did is give people, like, horrible future dreams. And he's like, well, I told you were fucked. And you didn't believe me.
See, the bizarre thing about that is, and this is actually a problem that Athena kind of has as well, is that they're just throwing this info at people with no context or explanation.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, why are you freaking out about it? And what I thought bugged me so much about that monologue with Nyx's actions was that he's set up as to be an intelligent person. Everyone in Tomorrowland is supposed to be pretty intelligent or creative or have some kind of higher value like that. And it drove me crazy. They never thought, maybe depressing people with images of this terrible future is in fact creating that terrible future. And it's a logical jump that Casey makes, and it's played as this, like, earth-shattering revelation. But I'm like, that's pretty basic reasoning.
Mm-hmm. There's also, I also pointed out that I think it's weird that, like, to get to this death future, you have to go through this, like, sort of wall of static. There's, like, we predict the future, blah, 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 and then there's static, and then there's a total future. And nobody was like, so what's that static?
It's like that,
should we investigate that?
There's that meme where it's, like, step one, do this, do two.
Question mark, profit.
Yeah, exactly.
Step three, apocalypse.
Yeah.
There's, like, some mystical static that, like, we're just going to assume is, like, whatever, and then, oh my god, the world's over. Like,
it also sort of just felt like Nyx was the designated villain.
Right. I think Nyx is more interesting as a Shades of Grey character than a villain, and I wish he had been, because the movie seems to think he's a villain despite the fact that he doesn't always come off as one. He comes off as sort of pragmatic and pessimistic, but not necessarily bad, until, like, the end when he gives that little monologue, and then at the end when he is crushed to death horribly, with a death befitting a villain.
I still feel like he didn't really need to die.
No, like, I feel kind of like it seems like to reflect poorly on Casey's character that she did not try to drag him away before he died. They had time, okay, we're gonna
a second, I'll lift Athena up into the thing, but before that, let's get this guy out of the slash zone.
It really is careless, and I think within the ethos of the film, I think a redemptive arc for this character would have been way more interesting.
But the
fact of the matter is that they give us all of this, like, very important plot detail, like, in the very last act of the film.
It's very
compressed.
Especially since you'd think and it's fine if he's going to be the villain of the piece, there needs to be a lot more screen time devoted to what he's actually doing.
And
what the falling down was in Tomorrowland that he was involved in, what the falling out was between him and Frank, there needs to be a lot more ground covered before I'm okay with him being crushed to death by a space elevator.
So the other, like, I think he's better as, like, a sad character than, like, unnecessarily, like, a violent
one. I don't think you need a villain.
Right, no, I don't, like, the villain is just, like, ourselves. Like, we are our own villain because, like, we have a tendency to be pessimistic about things.
Yeah, and
like,
the
that is the
conflict is there's this future.
Right.
And, like, it's, what do we do about this future? You don't need a villain to, like, represent, like, well, I guess you're all fucked.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I, like, again, to say, it's a monologue that I really do enjoy, his last one at the end. Like, the basic, like, it sums up as, like, you know, this is a, like, you are, we've been trying to show people that there's an apocalypse, and you seem to all be perfectly okay with it because you don't have to do anything. Because, mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
at heart, like, you are lazy people, and you don't want to make the changes you need to see that. Which, right. like, sort of, like, hits home for me, because, like, yeah. that is something that kind of terrifies me on a daily basis, that, like, maybe we are just too, like, docile to do anything about it. And right. so it is sort of, like, an interesting idea of, like, the concepts of, like, fear versus hope in terms of, like, the two. Like, yeah. it's, like, you know, trying to make people, like, you know, see the light through by scaring them, and trying to make people do it by, like, making them feel better, mm-hmm. and, like, what the two are. So, like, it's a neat concept, and it's just sort of wasted on Nix's kind of, like, ambivalence.
Yeah, I think that it's a little bit of a meta-commentary for the film and the state of blockbuster films in general, because this, I feel like the filmmakers wanted to make the movie an optimistic, peppy film that had a good moral center, compared to a lot of the, you know, the nihilistic, I don't know.
DC.
Yeah, there's just a lot of stuff out there that seems to revel in negativity, and this was kind of designed to be the antidote. Like, what happened to the good old days of the movies that made you feel great when you walked out of them? That sort of a thing.
It seemed like the ideal version of this movie, at least what they set out to make, was sort of a reconstruction, where it was going to bring back those old kind of more optimistic, idealistic feelings, but modulate them a little bit with a little more realism, mm-hmm. and addressing the concerns that Nix is ostensibly bringing to the table. And I enjoy that on paper and as a concept. That's really great. It completely fell apart in this movie, though.
Well, I think 2015 was an interesting time for this movie to happen, because, like, we are more cynical today. Kids are more cynical. Like, it's just a more cynical time than, like... And it's interesting that Disney, who once made this, like, Tomorrowland, you know, the park version of it, and, like, the whole concept, and, like, the whole, like, his original version of Epcot, where it was like, well, things are mm-hmm. gonna be great. We're gonna have a bright future. Like, that is something that, like, kids go to now at Disney World, and they're like, this is stupid. Like,
yeah, Disney,
man, this is lame and stupid.
Walt Disney had legitimate aspirations as, like, a futurist, wanting to design these special communities, and, you know, he was really active in a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And this could have been, like, this was an interesting time to, like, to sort of address that, like, we had these ideas once, and, like, maybe there were flaws in our plans, but, like, we shouldn't have dismissed it. We should never dismiss yeah. it as, like, stupid or
it's
or
sort
out of reach
or... interesting to me also that, like, this movie, which is should ostensibly be sitting on a shelf next to, like, Country Bears, Haunted Mansion, and Pirates of the Caribbean in terms of, like, theme park rides turned movies, mm-hmm. like, seems to be so much of a passion project for Brad Bird,
yeah.
and something that's, like, imbued with, like, so much genuine sort of, like, a message to it,
yeah.
where, like, those, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, just, like, it's like a fun action movie about pirates, and, like, this is more, like, saying something about, like, you know, like, your
yeah.
attitudes, and so, like,
I
it
mean,
is kind
by
of
that
neat.
Same token, I think that, like, Tomorrowland was built with more meaning behind it than Haunted Mansion. Like,
yeah.
Haunted Mansion and Pirates of the Caribbean were like, oh, it's a fun ride.
They're yeah. a little rote. They were a little bit more...
Yeah.
yeah.
But I feel like Tomorrowland and Epcot were built with, the like, this genuine passion behind it of, like, I want people to think about the future and, like...
Yeah.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and, you know, come up and have optimism and hope that, like, we'll have a great, like, a much better society someday.
Gotcha. It's kind of a good segue to another topic, which is the idea of Tomorrowland as being more like a fantasy fairy tale
mm-hmm.
sort of place versus, like, an actual sci-fi
yeah,
place
and
with rules.
I believe the creators viewed it as such in their...
Viewed it as what?
As a fairy tale.
Okay.
I think it has
I believe
to be.
In that article
right.
that they
interview.
Talk about that Tomorrowland as a sort of, like, fairyland concept.
Right.
Well, it's kind of like an unattainable future set
yeah,
there
right.
as you know, as something to follow, something to
strive for.
Yeah,
it's sort of it's like, and I can see that. The other, I guess, the sort of issue is when you bring things like tachyons into it, you sort of get into, like, you get away from, like, just don't worry about it. This is
mm-hmm.
science, and we figure
yeah.
it out, as opposed to, like, well, it's actually this, and we have these in your universe, and we're trying to figure out how it works. So, like,
yeah.
this is a thing, and maybe it'll be a thing in the future. So pay attention
right.
to it. But, like, it should really just sort of be more like, no, we've done it. Like,
yeah,
we're
yeah.
really good.
I would have appreciated a lot more if they didn't spend any time trying to explain it with science. I'm like, no, that's the wrong tack to take with this big spectacle movie. I'm like, just give me the flashing lights. We're good.
Okay, but so as soon as you talk about science versus magic, like, I think people will expect some degree of technobabble, but there's a fairy tale way of doing technobabble, as Doctor Who will tell you. Like,
yeah.
there's a way of
timey-wimey.
Yeah, there's a way of, like, acting like you're science, but really being magic.
Yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
doable. But, like, yeah, what Tomorrowland is like, what it should be is, like, a representation of optimism. Because
yeah.
it seems like that's the core message of the movie. So Tomorrowland is, like, a place where anything can happen, as Frank wishes in the beginning of the movie. So, like, I don't know why, like, one of the things I have with this movie is, like, these child robot recruiters, like, you could tell me that they're just, like, literal embodiments of optimism, and I would be okay with that, and not like, robots. Do you know what I mean? Because, right. like, mm-hmm. it really doesn't matter what they are. Like, you could tell me that, like, we use science to like, literally bottle up optimism and put them into children. Like, and I would be okay with that, versus, like, oh, they're just androids.
Yeah.
And it's just bizarre.
Yeah.
Brendan pointed out, the benefit is maybe they're more innocuous, they can get into more places, they can kind of maybe start a conversation in a more effective way, but it is a very bizarre choice to couch recruitment
coming
literally from the mouths of babes.
But back to tachyons for a quick second. If you tell me, oh, we're seeing this future a few seconds before it happens, her hat comes off, and then 2 seconds later, her hat comes off. And like, with the bomb, that would really blew my mind.
Well, I agree with you. The bomb is a weird thing.
She watches her future self turn the bomb on, and she's like, oh, that's how you turn the bomb on. And I'm like, how? So, like, she just blew my mind.
No, like, it's one of those, like,
in the first place.
So that could not have been, I mean, you kind of enter time loop territory.
Well, because that also seems to imply that, like,
its own muddlement, science or not.
That would also kind of, like, imply that it's the sort of, like, because, you know, you have, like, the two different, like, ways of time travel. You have time travel, you can change the past, and time travel where, like, it's always the same. And that seems to advocate that, like, it's the same because, like, she knew she could do it because she had already done it. But the movie, for the most part, espouses that we can change the future.
Yeah, time travel is a tricky thing to get
into. Yeah, it is.
And they, like, kind of broke a cardinal rule for me right there.
I think it got a little muddled with the
time. It is, but it's also like a throwaway gag.
Right. Yes. I was going to say, do you think they did it in the name of the sequence, which I could kind of see? Which,
I think that's a theme. That's a theme of things that we've noticed when we watch the film, is that a lot of things in this film, like, look really good, but if you think about it too hard, it absolutely breaks down.
Like, the Eiffel Tower breaks down. Literally.
It splits in half. Literally right down the middle.
Down the middle. And I love that contained in the Eiffel Tower is this chamber with, like, life-size models.
Animatronic Edison.
Edison, Tesla.
There's, like, wax. They're wax figures just sitting there. Yeah. They probably should be covered in a lot more dust. Yeah. This is,
and
like, a
not,
secret room.
They're, like, not publicly viewable, so who are they?
Why are? Yeah. For anyone having to pass on their way to the rocket ship inside the Eiffel Tower.
So, like, who are the four? Tesla, Edison,
Eiffel.
Einstein? No.
Was it Einstein? Who was the fourth? I was, by the way, when they were naming people, I was waiting for them to say
Walt Disney. I like that Eiffel.
Well, see, so actually, do you want to cover that? Do you know that?
Do I know what?
That initially they were going to talk about Walt Disney being a plus ultra. And
yes, there is.
So go into that.
There is a deleted scene. I don't know if it's on the DVD, but it is. It appeared in a Japanese trailer for the movie where when they're in the Blast from the Past comic book store and they're giving Casey kind of the lowdown on what the whole Tomorrowland project is. They bring Walt Disney into the fold and say that, well, he was part of this campaign to raise awareness in our side of the woods, so to speak, by putting it Tomorrowland in the theme parks so that the idea was seeded in the minds of all these children that came to visit them.
Interesting. That's actually a really cool way of putting
that in. I'm glad they cut it, though.
I think they cut it. It's a little cute.
Right. It gets a little too much to, like, making Walt Disney into, like, this sort of, like, iconic saint figure, I think, given the fact that it's, like, this is the company that bears his name,
it's
you're
a
in
little...
a tricky territory when you try and talk about your founder that way.
Yeah, it's a little masturbatory.
No, it is. Like, I get the point, but I think they made the right choice in cutting it.
I do, too. I do like that it exists.
Jules Verne was the fourth.
Oh, really?
Jules Verne. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
So Tesla, Edison, Jules Verne, and Gustav Eiffel.
By the way, and as I think we all kind of commented, it's very rich that Tesla and Edison could have ever stand to have been in
that
group together.
Yeah, I'd say, like, mark some points against Disney for continuing to foster the idea that
Edison the hero.
Do you think, like, Tesla got the invitation and, like, Edison was there? He's like, I must have gotten one too. It just, like, showed up the next day.
If that happened, Tesla.
No, I'm part of it now.
It is crazy because, I mean, Edison, it was this humongous jerk. Like, he was stealing machinery, research. He was, like, just... Edison was really just a monster.
Edison is a terrible monster. And it is a little upsetting that this movie chose Edison as one of those four people, because I think that we're sort of at the point where we kind of know that Edison was more of a jerk than we might have initially thought some years ago.
Maybe it's sort of like a two-step forward, one-step back scenario where it's like, they at least included Tesla. It wasn't Edison instead of Tesla.
I guess. I mean, at least, I'm glad Tesla got some representation,
but there could have been
someone else, instead.
But I feel like there
Tesla
was no...
is someone that would have benefited from a place like
Tomorrow. Yeah, frankly, let's be honest. Like, we would be in a better place.
Yeah,
if Tesla
wouldn't have gone crazy in a New York hotel.
Yeah,
fallen in love with a
pigeon.
But Edison would have probably gone the Nix route, if we're being honest. There would have been no Governor Nix. It would have been Edison.
Yeah,
Governor
Edison.
And
he could have shot those shakes.
Slugging back
those shakes. Guys, what if he is Edison?
Oh, I would love that, like, horrible twist at the last where he, like, pulls off, like, his fake hair, and he's like, it was me, Edison. Where's the fucking elephant?
Yeah, well, and also, we kind of have been circling this concept, especially in getting into Tomorrowland as this concept in kind of fairy tale place. It also, I think, has, as Lee was sort of pointing out when we were watching it, has a very dubious connection and relationship with the real world.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, but also as the movie presents it.
Sorry, wait, do you dubious connection with, like, our world or, like, the real world in the movie?
Kind of both, because it's, they sort of gloss over it in the movie, but to me, you were bringing up legitimate concerns about how, like, in this world, they would, if they were to expose themselves to us.
Oh, no, I believe, like, the whole opening the doors thing, I think, is a terrible idea. I don't think you would do it. I think that, like, you don't do it to Fairylands. You don't say, like, anyone can come into Fairyland. People go into Fairyland when they need to, when they have to go on a journey or learn something. You don't just, like, have free reign to go there.
Well, maybe you wouldn't have free reign. Maybe it would be more like a prestigious university, a research institute.
Like a Rhodes Scholar. Yeah.
I think you, like, it's sort of, Tomorrowland is different from a Fairyland to that extent, where in that, like, they sort of, it's not like a representation, it's not purely just a representation of optimism. It's also a place where, like, technology gets developed and presumably diseases will get cured, and we want to share that, but, like, that in itself, like, that gets more into, like, some real geopolitical concerns. Like, you're snatching up talent from all these countries, and they're gonna get jealous, and, like, you can't open it up because terrorists are gonna want to blow it up. And that's not stuff that you want to cover in a family movie. Like, it's boring. Kids don't want to care about that.
And here's something that's pathetic. That point was completely driven home for me when you likened it to the most recent Avengers movie, where you're like, and then they're gonna have to deal with that? And
yeah,
like,
they're gonna regulations, and, like, they have to sign contracts.
Civil
and, like, this is exactly the shit that they were trying to get away from, so they could come up with all these solutions.
So, like, I think it has to do a lot with, like, the recruitment process in general. Kind of becomes problematic because once Tomorrowland becomes a place that you're aware of, then everyone in the world knows that there is this alternate dimension called Tomorrowland where all the best and brightest will go. And then you find out that there are robots running around offering certain people to get into Tomorrowland. So, like, if you consider yourself, like, a person who has something to offer the world and, you know, your friend gets a pin and goes to Tomorrowland and you don't, like, do you become, like, a bitter, angry person over that? Like,
It's sort of, like, that takes away that optimism.
Right, so,
it's
like,
saying, you know that you weren't good enough for Tomorrowland.
I'm wondering if, like, if there's, like, a better way to recruit people. Like, there's, maybe it's not, like, actively seeking out, but maybe just, like, this person finds a way to Tomorrowland whenever, like, they feel like that they have something to offer.
Almost like a Narnia situation.
Yeah, it's like if you like somehow find your entrance to Tomorrowland.
Yeah, I think we're fully committing to
fairy tale science.
Yeah, which might not be a bad thing.
No, not at all.
Through all of this discussion about opening doors, it's never laid out what that means. They just keep talking about opening doors. It's very possible that opening the doors just means recruiting more people.
Right. Or it just means, like, showing up, like they put, like, a box with, like, the cure for cancer, like, on the step of the hospital.
Yeah.
Like you do with, like, an orphan baby. Be like, well, bye. And just, like, disappear again.
Yeah, like,
a little note that says, like, you're welcome.
Yeah.
It's possible that there's, I feel like this collective of scientists and artists and all that would have figured out that, like, we can help the real world, but we can't really, like, reveal our existence because then it's going to, like, shackle us down and cause problems.
And also, yeah, like you said, almost just create, like, a political distortion that would probably make the world a little bit of a tougher place.
Yeah, like a sort of, like, a genocracy. Like, it can't really exist alongside other governments because they're just gonna wanna, like, get in on the action, or, like, people are gonna wanna attack you, or they're not gonna wanna listen to you because you're gonna come off as, like, arrogance. They're gonna be, like, elves to the humans, you know what I mean?
Right,
like,
the fair folk.
Yeah, that's what it's gonna be like. So it's really not a good idea to keep yourself. I think interaction with the real world, and, like, I think people go there because they want to help the real world, but, like, I don't think that they should be exposed. Like,
in the film, they don't even give us a clear idea of what the original plan was before things went awry.
Right.
We don't even know by the end of the film what they're going to do next.
We don't even have a clear idea of what Tomorrowland was, because it's only really in barely a third of this movie.
Yeah. Right, well, we don't really know when Tomorrowland... Tomorrowland presumably came into being in the 1800s, I guess, right?
Yeah,
Like, if Eiffel and Verne and Tesla and Edison are working on it, presumably at some point in the 1800s, they created this alternate dimension somehow. And started Tomorrowland then. So, like, has Tomorrowland been in existence for, like, over 100 years by this point? At some point, they said, we're going to open the doors in 20 years. Back in the 60s, they said, we're open the doors in 20 years. So, presumably, this had been going on for a while. And then, all of a sudden, they were like, actually, let's open the doors in 20 years. It's been existing for longer than these 20 years. So, like, why did it take them so long to do this? Why did they want to do it then? I'm not sure what Tomorrowland's MO is, aside from being, like, a destination for all these creative, intelligent people.
It also completely saps the sense of stakes or what we're trying to get back to when we really don't know what Tomorrowland was.
Like, what if Tomorrowland wasn't a place where they built some that, like, humans built to house all these people? What if Tomorrowland was, like, a sort of, like, what's that word that Slenderman is, where a talpa? Where you summoned it
like into a thought existence with your thoughts.
Like,
yeah,
what if Tomorrowland was a place that, like, optimism in humans had created? And that, like, the people there weren't real people, but it was, like...
Like an ideal type.
Yeah, and, like, you would go, like a fairy tale fairyland, you would go there, you would be driven, you'd be guided there because you were this brilliant person with a brilliant idea, and Tomorrowland would help you get to the point where you could realize that idea.
And that's sort of what Brandon
And then you'd be done with it.
I mean, I would still like it to be a place with real people, because I think the entire point of the movie is about being collaborative. There's a lot about, like, the idea that, like, you know, you... And, like, one of the things I do appreciate about the movie is that it includes, like, artistic types and creative types, because, like, I think really to have, like, a good society, you need to have, like, those people. You can't just have, like, STEM-based education and everything goes from there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, I appreciate the fact that, like, this movie says, like, no, you need artistic types to make this a better place, too. So I think because this entire message is about collaboration, that it does have to be, like, it can still be a place that, like, was created by optimism, but,
no,
like,
there
have to be real people in it.
But, like, maybe that's the better... interpretation of it, is that it's not like a place where you go and you stay and you don't really do it. You collaborate and you work with other people, but, like, you live there. Maybe you go there to meet these... It's a place where you can meet like-minded people and work on stuff, but then you go back to the real world and you
and you bring that back. Which I actually think is maybe what they... I think what they've been driving home is that the point was not for Tomorrowland to shut itself off entirely. It was to give itself
back. But it is still
back.
Sort of... Because the implication is still that you live there.
Yeah, because we're never told, like, oh, this came from Tomorrowland did this first, and then we never hear anything about that. So,
even
like,
NASA,
they
they'll be like, this technology was developed... memory foam mattresses were developed for the space program.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Okay, great. NASA contributed something.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that what everybody is saying is that the true spirit of Tomorrowland was inside us the entire time.
Well, let's call it night, guys.
Good night, everyone.
So I think it also there's also sort of like a weirdness to that, because the implication that, like, baby Frank Walker at age 7 or 8 was whisked away to Tomorrowland, and, like, did he stay there for, like, the next 20 years and never go home?
I mean, he had a shit dad.
Yeah,
no, I know, his
jerk.
Dad was still a jerk, but, like, nonetheless, like, is it this group's MO to, like, still find children and, like, keep them there? Like, do these kids only go to Tomorrowland on weekends? Like, what...
Sidebar, by the way, his dad was a cartoonish jerk.
What dad in, like, the 60s sees a kid with, like, a nearly functioning jetpack and is like, you'll never run out to anything?
Very advanced mechanics and science at work here, and he's like, shut the fuck up and stop what you're doing. And I was like, whoa!
He probably was still bitter that Frank disassembled the Electrolux and needed a vacuum.
Have we made the point, however, that, like, for a movie called Tomorrowland, we don't spend enough time there.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to get at. It's not in that movie that much.
And the creators, I've reportedly intended it to not be that case, which is just wrong. Like, you can't really... I'm sorry, but you fucked up.
So,
you called it Tomorrowland and we don't go there.
We've got Brad Bird and we've got Damon Lindelof writing the screenplay.
Damon Lindelof
being a very divisive figure.
I don't mind him.
I have mixed feelings on him, as I think we all should by this point. And this is, I think, probably one of the more coherent and things he has done. Whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing is up for, you know, this is the most coherent he can come up with. But, you know, it's still better than, like, say, Prometheus or something like that.
To some extent, I understand the idea of making it a road movie because Tomorrowland is a fairyland, blah, blah, blah. But, like, it was just the wrong direction to go.
Yeah.
It was. And it felt like it meandered and it felt like it just missed its own point. Like, it's titled Tomorrowland. So much of the story is about that. So much of it is about getting back to something we're not introduced to. So much is about people from there, people doing things there, people bringing things back from there. But we never see it and we don't really experience it outside of this fake illusion that Casey sees from that pin. And that really annoys me, because I'm like, then what's this all about?
We're just told that it's important over and over again.
If the illusion was all
we
ever saw, that would be a better movie.
What?
If the illusion was all we ever saw.
Yeah, that would be a much better movie.
It was fully unattainable.
Yeah, like, we saw this illusion, and we spend the rest of the movie chasing after it, but by the end we realize something that we don't need. The illusion is a goal, not a destination.
Again, Tomorrowland is inside us all.
That is inside us all. That, like, maybe Tomorrowland was never real, and maybe it died a long time ago, but, like, it doesn't matter, we can make it happen.
Interesting.
That's the road movie.
Yeah. No, that's true, because Tomorrowland is an actual physical destination. We spend so little time there. And again, movie being called Tomorrowland, I think you're not incorrect as an audience member to sit there thinking, when will we see Tomorrowland?
Where's my Tomorrowland?
Yeah, no, exactly.
Even if you were to title it and we never saw it, I think that's doable. You guys were kind of outlining a way that could have been done. Mm-hmm. But then you need to take out everyone reiterating nigh infinitum that it's so important. It's all, we're all about it. It's this big thing. Like, yeah. You can't have that in the movie and then we don't see it.
Yeah, this is... And I feel like this movie tries to have it both ways and surprise the audience when we finally actually get to Tomorrowland, but it also gives up the goods. Like, in the first 5 minutes of the film, you are there with Frank, and then you are seeing it with with Casey, whereas we really should follow, like, we should be in Casey's shoes for this journey more.
Yeah.
And we should see it when she gets to see it, not when Frank sees it.
You mean maybe so that Casey could have a journey?
Exactly, yeah.
There's the other sort of issue with Tomorrowland in general is that there seem to be at most 10 people in Tomorrowland.
Yeah, what happened to all the people?
We see a bunch of dark silhouettes come out of their homes at the very end of the movie.
But there's all we really, really see are we see Governor Nix and we see some of his henchmen slash bodyguards, and that's it. Yeah. There is like no one wandering around the city, and I understand that they wanted to try and make it a more, I guess, depressing place. But it seems like for all intents and purposes that up until the end that they are just the only 10 people left in Tomorrowland.
Here's a question. If there was a big, we see Tomorrowland under Nix's rule and it's not doing well. Was everybody forced to stay there even though things have gotten really bad?
Because they never say it outright, but it does have like light trappings of like a police state.
Yeah.
Like, it's the militaristic outfits, the...
Yeah. Well, Nick shows up with a heavy guard detail.
But they never say that.
And he seems to control the only way in and out of Tomorrowland, aside from, like, going from Earth to Tomorrowland.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like, I wish, like, if we had known that there was a struggle and, like, there are certain people who disagree with him and, like, maybe there's, like, an underground resistance, like, to Nix who, like, are opposed to what he's doing.
That could have been.
Yeah. Would have been fascinating.
And want to stay and, like, stay there Tomorrowland maybe, so maybe, like, Casey has to, like, team up with them toward the end of the movie or something like that. But, like, we just don't get it. Like, we just don't get anything about Tomorrowland. Like, how did Nix attain this position? Like, he just sort of shows up and he says, well, like, I guess I'm the bad guy now because we're running out of time.
And I was snooty in the beginning of the movie, so now I'm full on evil.
And it's true, actually, because I think every character except for Frank is static. Mm-hmm. No one really changes. No one has an epiphany, really.
No.
And Casey, for being the savior, is just sort of dropped into this, and we're just sort of told it's through her optimism that she saves everything, but I was never really sold on the idea that she had anything special.
I would argue that even Athena has more of a journey.
She does.
Athena does have a journey.
Yeah.
I would say.
Because she laughs by the end.
Yeah.
She does.
I think also that there's one thing that the movie doesn't sort of wholeheartedly commit to is it sort of posits this idea of Casey as the chosen one, but it also kind of doesn't. So like...
It doesn't go full whole hog into that idea. It's kind of like, oh, she's kind of a little bit special and she can do this.
Well, like, honestly, she's the one that made it, right? Because the other one's like probably died. Are we guessing
Because Athena kind of mentions that she gave her last pin, and we're meant to assume the others were just shot by Catherine Hahn.
But, like, so what
I want to see a montage of that.
Catherine Hahn killing people. I would be so thrilled to see Catherine Hahn, Keegan-Michael Key, just, like, different combinations of them just zapping people.
What a lovely dark note to be, too. Like, that, like, it's not... Did Casey... is just the one that made it.
Yeah, right. No, like, which I love, because I love, like, one of my favorite things is, like, the subversion of the Chosen One trope, because, like, Harry Potter sort of does this even, where it's, like, actually, like, you're the Chosen One because, like, Voldemort made you the Chosen One. Like, there's nothing special about you in any way, shape, or form, except that Voldemort said, you're going to be, like, my nemesis.
Right.
And so, like, I like that, and I like the idea that Casey is not that special, and she just got there by sheer dumb luck because they got to Frank quicker or something like that. And frankly, like, the end of Tomorrowland should be more about the fact that, like, it's not one person who saves Tomorrowland. Like, it is she and Frank who saved Tomorrowland by teaming up, and then we need more people to get it back to where it was in the first place.
But I feel like the movie doesn't completely commit to that.
No, it doesn't.
I want them to put that out more.
Well, I think collaboration is important, but I feel like what the movie drives home, what Frank's journey is hope and optimism.
Yeah.
And that's what he gets back.
Right.
And she says, like, you needed motivation. Like, he had the answers within him all along, as would we all, but, like, nobody had the optimism or the hope to find those answers.
Which really makes Athena the ultimate mastermind here, because she's, like, stuck them together.
Well, again, because she is not human... She doesn't have the same barrier that Frank has. She has a journey unto herself, but I feel like she doesn't have the barrier of giving up hope. Because, like she says, she's programmed to find dreamers. Mm-hmm. She's not the one that has ideas, but she finds people who do.
She's just running through her program like she's supposed to.
So the one last thing I want to kind of cover is the Brad Bird's relationship with objectivism in terms of what people perceive it to be. In that, anytime you go on the internet and sort of look at like any sort of criticism of any of Brad Bird's movies, so like we've got The Incredibles, we've got Ratatouille, Iron Giant to a lesser extent. This was the fourth Mission Impossible, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Ghost Protocol, yes. And which was really good. Tomorrowland, and I think that's pretty much all he's done, right?
Yes.
Thanks. So.
There's always a discussion about the idea that Brad Bird's movies are somehow Randian or objectivist in nature, in the sense that they all seem to be about people with special gifts who are burdened by society or the government and are unable to reach their full potential until they throw off those shackles.
I reject that outright.
As
we all should.
You talked about this, and the first time I heard about it was from you, and I scoffed at it, and I have nothing more to say. Like, they're just dumb. Anyone who thinks that is dumb.
Brad Bird says that, too.
I've watched all of his movies, now that you've enumerated them, and it just seems almost like a willful misreading of what's in front of them. Because, like, you were kind of saying, like, you could see Tomorrowland as being, objectivist, specifically in the vein of, like, John Galt, if they only watch, like, the first half of the movie. And that's what's frustrating to me. Does that mean that someone just, like, well, I've seen all I need to see? If anything, his movies show you how Randian attitudes are detrimental to society, are negative, and are going to get you nowhere.
Right. There's a lot, and I think, really, like, what he seems to be saying in almost all of his movies, I think, is the idea that we have to work together to attain a goal. It's not that you should be in it for your own self-interest. It's that you have to see what other people have to offer, that there is something that you are very good at, but there's another person who's also very good at something. So work with them to achieve your goal.
I think the only person who is a proponent of Randian values is Ayn Rand. The fuck you say that dumb
Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand.
Yeah. Fucking dumbass name. Dumbass person.
I mean, and we don't have to, we shouldn't go into it entirely, but it's bastardized. Yeah. Like, her views and how they work and what they are. Objectivism, for me, has always just been, like, very much dime store philosophy. It's very round, uncomplicated. Yeah. It's undemanding of you. And all
doesn't
requires
doesn't ask anything of you today.
Yes.
No.
Exactly. And the characters who espouse this philosophy the most are the villains.
Yes. Like,
Syndrome in The Incredibles is all about making himself the best because he wants to be the best.
Right.
Not because he wants to help society. He wants to create a robot threat so that he can step in and be looked on as like a savior. Mm-hmm. And Nyx in this is just interested in like his own self-preservation. He's not interested in helping others.
Which, if anything, these movies refute those ideas and show you how, if you do have these gifts, if you do feel that you are really good at this one thing, then try to use that to better other people, which I think is a really beautiful thing to say. And I just don't see how you see that value and be like, oh, God, objectivism, right? I'm like, no! Come on!
Yeah, so if you think that about Brad Bird, then I hope you feel bad about yourself.
Because you're wrong!
I think Ratatouille sort of sums this up really well, because Ratatouille's philosophy in the opening of the movie is based on the idea that anyone can cook, which is a very sort of like simplistic, kind of straightforward moral. And then at the end, whenever Anton Ego is giving his review of Gustav's restaurant under Remy the Rat's, what's the word I'm looking for here?
Control?
Yeah.
His brief tenure as
head chef. Anton Ego says that like he understands that what Gustav the chef actually meant was not that anyone can be a great artist, but a great artist can come from anywhere. And I think that's a really good philosophy to have.
Yeah.
Brad Bird, I think, in his movies is not saying that like we're all good and so we should all acknowledge that we are all good and everyone gets a trophy. He's saying that like you are good at this thing. Use that gift to like be the best that you can. And you may not be as good as someone else is something, but find what you are good at and find like what like you have strengths and use them for. And I think that's a really good message to have in a movie, especially for something like in a kid's movie, like Ratatouille, I think has a really great message in that sense.
I think it's a really nice thing.
Did we cover everything pretty much?
Well, that was all of, that was a litany I had written down.
Right.
We can just talk about things we liked.
Yeah.
Things we want to treasure and hold close. I'll start with Catherine Hahn and Keegan-Michael Key were fantastic in this movie. Not enough of them. I want the whole movie based on them. Obviously not. But it was, they're just such a joy to see.
Yeah, I think most of the performances were great.
Agreed.
I think that the direction there was just, all the character work was very, very, very solid.
Yeah.
A lot of it was naturalistic, weirdly, given for how like heightened and high concept everything was. What was her name? Raffi Cassidy.
She's
incredible.
She's unbelievable.
Yeah. Like, one of the best, like, child performances I think I've seen, like, maybe ever.
Yeah.
Like, she has such authority and wisdom and conviction with everything she says. Like, you buy her completely as a robot who is, like, smarter than everyone else in the room.
Yeah, who is also older and more mature than everyone else.
She sells it in the attitude, she sells it in the way she delivers her lines, and she even sells it physically.
Yeah, she carries herself.
There's just enough, like, stiffness and, like, ramrod posture to her body that you believe it, but not so much that it would stick out hugely. It was a brilliant performance. Yeah. And I hope that she just, you know, makes shitloads of money, wins all the Oscars in the future.
Retroactively gets that Oscar.
I'll put forward my favorite aspect of the movie, which a lot of my fix is going to focus on more of, is the Frank and Athena relationship. Mm-hmm, I think it's great. I actually really love the idea that he didn't know that she was a robot and that he sort of developed these feelings for her. And it was pretty, I think it's pretty clearly that he had a crush on her as a kid, because he has a line that, like, he cuts himself off before he says fall in, like, in love or something like that. And I love it. I love, like, when they meet again and she's still the same and he's now George Clooney. And they bicker, like, they fall back into this, like,
old couple. They bicker like an old couple. Yeah, yeah. It's awesome.
Like, old couple bickering. I love it. And I like the whole, I think they have a really good arc. I want more of it. And I want, like, more the scenes we didn't see, like, when did he find out that she was a robot? We never know.
Given those, the how strong those performances were, and it is terrible.
Yeah,
and we didn't get to see more of that.
Wouldn't you have loved to see a scene between him getting kicked out and him knowing that she was a robot? Like, I imagine in my head, like, you know, they couldn't have, like, not been, they couldn't have, like, not talked to each other for, like, 10 years or 15 years or however long it took. But and I imagine he was still some, like, she was still a sounding board to him through all that time, but maybe there was just, like, sort of an edge to their friendship.
Yeah, it's almost, it's like kind of having, like, we're with your ex or something. Like, you might be getting along, okay, but there's, like, a certain, like, shortness in, like, attention, whatever you're saying to each other.
Yeah, and that would have been a great evolution of, like, another, you know, another step in their dynamic that we didn't really get, you know, a look into.
Yeah.
But, oh well.
Brendan, what do you got?
Oh, man. There are actually a lot of things about this movie that I really like.
Hit us.
The score is pretty good. Brendan will recall that when we saw this film and I came out of it, I thought that the score was a lesser Giacchino score, but it has grown on me a lot. It's got some pretty great themes in it. I really love the performances. Raffi Cassidy, like we were talking about, Britt Robertson, is that her name? She also did a tremendous job, even though her character is, you know, it's a little flat. Her development isn't awesome. Some of the special effects are gorgeous, and some of the scenes are highly inventive and very visually stunning. The art direction is great. The costumes, like we were all noting while watching the film, are out of this world in some cases. Nyx wears an awesome suit that I'm lusting after. It has it has no lapels. It's super sleek. It fits in with the 1964 aesthetic perfectly, but it also looks like it's, you know, 10, 20 years beyond that somehow. I was iffy on this film when I saw it the first time, and watching it every time since, like, I noticed little things about it that I feel like a lot of people would have enjoyed about it, but they didn't because they didn't see it.
So I will sort of segue into your talk about, like, the score with my favorite segment, looking to score. And I have to honestly say, like, this is probably of the movies we've talked about. There are a few, like, I think, like, John Ottman's work on Jack the Giant Slayer was pretty solid. I think Hans Zimmer's with The Lone Ranger was probably the best that Hans Zimmer and his ghostwriters have done in a while. But that being said, Michael Giacchino's score to Tomorrowland is terrific. Like, it's one of my favorite film scores, I think. There's not a whole lot I really have to offer, just because there's not much I have to say except for, like, praise. But there's, like, a lot of great work with themes. You have, like, a Tomorrowland theme. You have, like, a main theme. And there's... basically, I feel like at this point that whenever John Williams stops doing Star Wars scores for whatever reason, Michael Giacchino seems like the heir apparent to take up this mantle.
Yeah,
because
100%.
He has ties with the Disney Corporation. He's worked with a lot of directors that they have, and he's proven himself with Star Trek also that he can handle sort of like a space adventure movie. And honestly, like, as much as I love John Williams and I think he's terrific, like, I really hope that Michael Giacchino gets a chance to do a Star Wars score at some point, because love to hear what he has to do. And I think honestly it would be just as good as anything Williams has done with the franchise at this point. So it's one of those things that makes me feel like okay about what will happen when, like, this one person who has meant so much to the franchise steps away, because you have someone who is super talented who can very easily be part of it. So Michael Giacchino's score is terrific. By all means, please, like, just look for the end credits theme on YouTube or something and listen to that, because it's a really nice summary of all the different themes.
Or buy it.
Or just,
go give Michael Giacchino a couple of bucks.
That's right. Toss a couple of bucks in Giacchino's pocket.
But 8 thumbs up.
Yes. So now that we've covered all the things that we like, I guess we should go into fixes. And actually, I think I'm going to start with Brendan, because Brendan has, like, an actual, more than any of us right now, has a reason for being here.
He did actually fix it.
Yes.
I tried. I tried my darndest.
Tell us a little bit about what you did first.
Well, watching the movie, and the more I talked it over and the more I thought about it, I realized that a lot of the problems in this film were in editorial. There are a lot of sequences that are redundant. There are a lot of character beats that maybe don't work or aren't necessary. And so I was able to excise around 15 minutes of the film from its overall running time, including the end credits. And I actually added back in the Plus Ultra animated vignette into the
Since we didn't mention that, explain that a little bit.
They did kind of a retro-styled animated explanation of the Plus Ultra project, which was, you know, founded by the four science guys, and that's what Tomorrowland was. And it was it's an option on the Blu-ray if you watch the Blu-ray to watch it in front of the film like we did tonight. And I felt like seeing it and looking at, you know, the aesthetic is just like spot on for 1960s, and it has Maurice LaMarche doing his best Orson Welles impression as the narrator, and I feel like it sets the tone really well. And I other Brendan was telling me that there were some theaters where the animated introduction was shown, and I don't know why it wasn't exhibited everywhere, so I just put that right on the front of my edit to start things off. I eliminated the framing device that we all were befuddled by. My Tomorrowland, I didn't want to see Tomorrowland until Casey saw Tomorrowland, and so I cut out the entire sequence where Frank goes to Tomorrowland and has his rocket pack fixed and is flying around. You don't get that. You see him go somewhere, and then we cut to present day with Casey, and a lot of Casey's scenes are truncated too. Instead of having Casey go back to the launch pad twice, I have her go to the launch pad once. And you miss out on a lot of the character development and learning about her family and her brother, and you miss the Right Wolf anecdote, which I think is the only thing, one of the only things that really bugged me about the end result of my own cut, is that you don't get that nice bow on top at the end with the calling the Right Wolf back into the situation when Casey has her little epiphany.
Just right. Real quickly, the Right Wolf is
optimism versus
yes, right. Depends on what you
hope
feed.
Versus despair.
Yeah. So if you feed then that's
don't
sort
feed
of what,
despair.
Right,
feed
don't feed despair, feed optimism. Optimism is the Right Wolf. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
So that's that. I think that's one of the only missing pieces out of the end result that I came up with. But a lot of the major problems of the film that I couldn't fix were so tightly edited together in the last act of the film where, like, the real plotty stuff comes into play. I couldn't do anything there, unfortunately. And so a lot of those flaws remained. Even though, you know, the surprise and reveal of Tomorrowland, I think, is enhanced, and the road trippiness of the film is brought out a little bit more, and some of the redundant beats and some of the transportation sequences where everybody's shaking and looking crazy get cut out. So I think that it gets you, at least if, you know, even if we don't agree that whether or not it should have been a road trip movie, I tried to embrace that more and get the characters to their destination just a little bit faster. In this case, like 15 minutes faster.
Is there anything else you would fix if you had your druthers?
Oh my gosh. well, we were talking about this earlier. I've heard from a few people that I know that there is a longer cut that exists somewhere. They whittled down to the theatrical cut and that it's somewhere around 3 hours. And I'm not sure what the footage was and whether or not it was usable, but I would love to see that movie and kind of, you know, rework my cut from that footage. Other than that, really, the fixes that I would like to see are all, like, story, script-based, like, things that weren't conceived properly in the first place. You know, there are a lot of problems that happen in editing, but there are also clearly a lot of things that they didn't have fully fleshed out in the screenplay when they started filming, and things that they changed on the fly. Like, you know, they wanted to look at Casey's home life a little bit more, and, you know, a commentary on the plight of the middle class. You know, there's a lot of people, I think it's Casey's uncle and aunt and their kid are living in the house, and a lot of things about the economy like that. Things that they really didn't need to go into, that hit the cutting room floor, they ended up shooting because they didn't have a real tight grasp on what the script needed to be. And so, you know, I did what I could with what they actually shot. But if there's more footage out there, I'd like to see that. But, you know, the rest of the problems we've discussed in detail. It's stuff that just wasn't fully formed. It was still a little embryonic when they decided to make the movie.
Lee, why don't we go to you next?
Sure. I probably have the most radical version.
You always
version
do.
Of,
yeah.
Of the movie.
You always like to take us off the map.
Yeah,
but,
go for it.
I initially had thought, like, my very first reaction was like, well, we need to definitely see more Tomorrowland. And I like the three characters that we have, but we need to do more with them. And then I was like, wait a minute, actually, we don't need Casey at all. And I kind of, like, thought about that because, like, really, you need Frank, who is the representation of, like, lost hope, and you need someone to be a foil to him and to represent not lost hope. And Athena does that just as well as Casey, and to some extent does it even better than Casey, because Athena also has a journey a bit unto herself and has a pre-existing relationship with Frank. So My fix would basically have them be the two main characters, where it starts the same way, where she's sort of is instrumental in recruiting him to Tomorrowland, and he still gets kicked out for something he did, which we may not need to learn until the end of the movie. But the second part of the problem, which is that we don't see the sort of like Tomorrowland as it should be, rather than the sort of shit version that Governor Nick seems to rule over. So I would definitely have more of that, and I think the way that I would do that is because I still like the idea of what Frank seems to think is inevitable, is that the world is literally days are numbered. But with this whole, like, seeing a future thing, instead of that, I kind of want there to be a mechanic where Frank and Athena need to sort of go between the sort of past Tomorrowland and the future Tomorrowland to sort of restore, you know, or fix whatever problem caused the days to be numbered in the first place. And I thought that, like, maybe whatever mechanism allows them to travel back in time also means that whenever they're in the past, that Frank would still be played by, like, with a child actor that portrayed him. But he would just have the like the same maturity level as George Clooney's Frank. And I thought it would be like a good visual metaphor for like a Frank that had optimism and hope still versus the Frank that doesn't. And you still have that journey of like Athena being the one to show him that like, you know, there's still hope and there's still, you know, opportunity for change. And I think you talked a lot about the thing being about like Tomorrowland being about collaboration and how they all need to work together. And I think that those are important, but I feel like what the movie was really trying to drive at was optimism versus cynicism. The other thing I would do with Tomorrowland, which I feel like is a missed opportunity, especially for the way that Disney operates nowadays, particularly like parts of Disney World, is that like, but you had this opportunity to be somewhat educational and to show things that are not possible because of money or whatever reason, but we know things are scientifically viable. Mm-hmm. Like we know that there are like, much better ways of growing plants, or like ways of growing plants for like places that are undergoing drought. Like we've come up with a lot of these solutions that we've not been able to implement. And I feel like it would have been a good like sneaky educational moment for kids to show some of that in action in Tomorrowland of like, hey, here's some stuff that like, you know, we were able to figure out without restrictions.
Because, like maybe, yes, this is a fantasy world, but this is actually something you could make happen.
Yeah, it's a fantasy future world, but some of this stuff is we could do now. Like, yeah. It would be really a cool opportunity to showcase some of that.
My main, if I had to pick one, my main complaint with this movie is that it not only takes so long to really get to the plot stuff. Like we've kind of mentioned in many different ways, the plot does not really come together until the third act, which is crazy. Honestly, my fix cuts out almost everything that happens outside of Tomorrowland, and we spend almost the entire movie inside of it. There's too much that happened in that movie that sets up so much of the plot that we don't see or really get a satisfactory answer about. We don't really see Frank grow up in this situation. We don't see his conflict with Athena. We don't see his conflict with Nyx. We don't see his conflict with the society that had him kicked out to begin with. We can make reasonable suppositions about it, but we don't really know. And I think you could potentially keep Casey in this situation, but I do think, and I think she could be a much more dynamic, more fleshed out character if you cut out a lot of the parts I feel are extraneous, like most of the real world things. If you cut that out, you're giving yourself a lot more time to dig into things, to dig into character development, make sure Casey also has a journey, to dig into the conflicts which are hinted at but not actually shown, and to get into more, really bring more to the forefront this battle between you know, pessimism and cynicism versus optimism and hope. And just because, like, as we've also said, those ideas are put out there, but they're not developed. And that drives me crazy because I actually think this could have been a very beautiful, hopeful movie. And it is in spirit. And I do still sort of get that, but it's very wobbly.
Okay. What I kind of have, a lot of the points that I sort of brought up are things I kind of want to see in the movie, like the idea that there should be a Tomorrowland resistance movement kind of that we have to work with, that like maybe we meet them in Act 3, and so like Casey has to work with them. And on that note, one of the interesting things that, Brendan, you had brought up earlier when we were talking is that in the deleted scenes, there's an alternate version of this scene where Casey is at school and she's hearing all these depressing things, where in the movie, you see her and she's raising her hand and wants to be noticed and wants to, like, have the teacher call on her because she wants to know what we can do to fix these problems. But in the deleted scene, it's her being very bored and just sort of not into it whatsoever. And so it sort of lends the idea that at one point there was kind of a journey for Casey. And I think they made the right call in making Casey entirely optimistic versus George Clooney's pessimism. But But I think what Casey's journey should be is that Casey has to learn to work with people. That Casey can be very smart, but she's a very smart person who's just sort of like all doing it by herself. Maybe we see like footage of her like with like a lab partner or something, and Casey's just like having none of it, and she's just like, no, just go stand over there. Like, mm-hmm. I'll do it. Like, I'll do this all. And so like it's about her learning to like use her gifts to like work with other people. So she has to cooperate with this resistance movement at the end to save it. She has to cooperate with George Clooney to sort of get things done at the end. And so like that does give her sort of a reason to be there, because Lee, like, I think what you're saying is completely valid 100% that she doesn't have a lot to do, mm-hmm. but I do like Casey as a character and I like the performance of the actor, so I would like to give her something to do in there.
Yeah, I agree with that.
She seems worthy of more material.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't mind her. I also just like Athena and Frank more.
Oh yeah,
I
no,
want more of them.
No, and like and to be fair, like
Casey, so I can get more of that
completely fine time. Because they're really they're interesting characters and they're really well portrayed.
And their dynamic is I want to know more because I did not
get
it.
Yeah. And I love that this movie,
the most unique thing about the movie, I think, the Frank Athena like dynamic is like just like I've not seen anything like that.
Yeah,
yeah. And the fact that this movie has three main characters and two of them are women and one of them is a girl.
Yeah,
it's great.
That's awesome. And the girl kicks all kinds of butt.
Yeah, right.
That's great.
She is their muscle.
Yeah. She is. Yeah, she's the heavy. It's amazing. And I said this when we were watching the movie, but last year we had a lot of kick-ass heroines, and it kind of sucks that this movie, because nobody saw it, nobody is talking about like. Has positive, optimistic, you know, active female characters mm-hmm. in the forefront.
I would also want to say that I think in my version, Frank would not show up at all until Casey sees him. We wouldn't get the prologue of him as a kid whatsoever.
That's good.
That's interesting.
I think it sort of gives him, it puts him toward the side a little bit more. I think it's sort of similar in the sense that, like, Han Solo in The Force Awakens has a character journey in terms of like where he is then versus where he needs to be at the end of it. And it's not the main thing that you focus on, but he changes a little bit from like sort of like distant and apathetic toward like wanting to do something more. And I think that's kind of more what Frank needs to do, is that he still needs something to go to, and he should definitely still have a journey, but it should not be, I think, probably as prevalent as the movie makes it out to be. So I think I would sideline him just a little bit. And I think just two other real quick things. I want Nix to be more of a Shades of Grey character. Like, he's sort of like a sad bureaucrat, maybe, more than like an outright kind of like malicious. Yeah. He's not like necessarily malicious. He's just kind of like, maybe he's been beaten down himself by like the realities of like trying to help save the world, and he's just not able to do it. And again, it goes back to like working with other people. Like, mm-hmm. Nix is not able to do it himself, but for whatever reason, he thinks that it's like it's all on his shoulders. And so, like, he's trying to do it this way, and he won't hear anyone else's point of view because he's just gotten into his head that, like, no, this is my job to do it.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, maybe he was the one, it was him and George Clooney who were both working on the machine, or for whatever reason, like, maybe George Clooney left of his own volition out of Tomorrowland because Nix was just like not getting it properly.
Yeah.
And so, you have that. And also, just in general, like I said, more time to the apocalypse. Like, it feels very rushed that, like, within about the span of 2 months, like, our world will come to, like, a hellish end.
And it seems to come out of nowhere.
Right. I mean, I guess it's the idea is just to give it more of a ticking clock than if you say, like, well, in, like, 2 years, the world will end. It's kind of like, well, okay. But, like, I guess if you say within 2 months, it's more of a call to action. And I get that.
I would argue that you could have the urgency even if it was, like, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Because just, like, the fact that it's that the monitor is telling you.
Yeah, that's true.
Just as long as it's like George Clooney's character says, like, what if I could tell you when you're gonna die? That is like the doom scenario. Like, that's like the weight on your shoulders.
Right. It doesn't matter like if you're going to die a week from now or like 70 years from now, you still know.
I mean, if we were all told as a society that like the world was gonna blow up in 100 years, mm-hmm. we would be like, there would be chaos now. Like, we'd all just give up now. Like,
yeah.
Because what's the point? You know what I mean? Like, there, like, that's the urgency is knowing when it's going to happen, right. Not like how soon it's going to happen.
Yeah, that's valid. That's valid.
Yeah.
What was your Nix fix?
So, rather than so you.
But was that like the Variety headline?
The Nix fix. So you focus on the collaboration aspect, whereas I was definitely latching onto the more optimism pessimism thing. Mm-hmm. So I think you can have him as a Shades of Grey character where he's not an outright villain. Where maybe his strategy was like, okay, well, the world's going to end. We definitely can't fix this problem, but I can at least, like, maybe, like, know it up and like, do an arc thing. Like, so maybe what he could be doing is like, well, the Earth is fucked, but I can get the seeds ready, and I can get the animals ready, and I can preserve all the great works of art, because there was that subplot of him stealing art.
So weird that was cut out.
But maybe he could be doing that to, like, keep it alive.
I think it needed to be cut out.
Yeah. I'm saying, like, so weird that was filmed, is what I meant to say.
Yeah.
Well, they filmed a lot of stuff that they didn't end up even using remotely in the film.
Yeah. And that was what gave me, when I heard that that was a deleted scene, that was what gave me this arc idea that, like, well, maybe he wants to preserve the arc because he wants to keep some of the stuff alive. And maybe he's like, all right, well, we'll just ride out this.
The best of Earth may persevere.
Yeah, maybe we'll ride out this apocalypse and then we'll just have to repopulate the Earth when it's all done. And maybe that was his, like, I'm doing what I think is right thing.
Like a well-intentioned extremist. I mean, which is more interesting than what we got on screen.
If you accept that you can't save the world, then what can you do? You can at least preserve some of it.
Doesn't that make him like Ozymandias in
But, like, better clothes.
Yeah, way better outfits.
Like, I was even going to say, you talked about his suit at the World's Fair.
You want the 60s suit, but I want that coat.
Yeah. Lee was obsessed with the coat and the asymmetric
shirt.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The jodhpurs.
Yeah.
I hated those jodhpurs. But the coat had that really cool, like,
I'll take or leave
like
the jodhpurs.
Armor-plated, like,
yeah, all the way down the sleeve. Yeah.
I gotta have that
so
coat.
So cool.
Yeah.
Clothes in general. Like, we were, like, just when Casey's seeing that vision of Tomorrowland, there's, like,
fabulous.
An Indian woman and her husband
the
with
future
her daughter.
Indian
yeah.
clothing.
And this Indian woman has, like, the most amazing outfit. It's such a twist.
The guy is wearing that like the tunic with like a beautiful gradient.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's like white and then it has this beautiful glittery fade into blue. Like
yeah.
Oh.
It's like if nothing else, like the production design in this movie is outstanding.
Yeah.
Like it's pretty terrific. So off of that note, would we recommend this movie to people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's an enjoyable watching.
Easy
experience.
Recommendation.
Yeah. Yep. No, I agree. It's fun. It's like it's imperfect as we said, but it's certainly not unenjoyable. It's breezy
enough.
It's
tragic that it's flawed, isn't
yeah.
it? Like, yeah. It's because it was so fun.
I would actually say it's... I would actually put this above Jack the Giant Slayer for as close to fine as
oh,
we
yeah.
could get.
Yeah, no, I'd agree.
Because Jack the Giant Slayer had just... awful. Just the worst CGI. Just awful. For 2013, it's like a shame.
It did.
But... at the time, we were saying, wow, this is the closest to good we've gotten so far.
Yeah.
I would say Tomorrowland is now
no, it is.
Closest
yes. Even
to
Tomorrowland.
Tops Jack.
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah, I think it's an easy recommend from all of us. So, by all means, like, please be one of the 10 people who have seen this movie.
Yeah.
Go out and give it a rent. Download the soundtrack from iTunes or something. But it's definitely, I think, worth your time. It's not a huge investment.
Catch that retro-futuristic optimism.
Yeah.
And go to Disneyland. That's where the real Tomorrowland is still.
Yes, never forget, kids. The real Tomorrowland can only be seen in Disney theme parks. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's about all we've set out to do here.
Yeah.
Just wanted to, again, as always, facebook.com/whywatchpodcast, on Twitter at whywatchpodcast, and our website at dratpack.com, which we're working on figuring out some article stuff to throw up on there as well, because
mm-hmm.
We have time to kill. We need to do something with our lives.
So. We need to make a...
I have time
need...
to kill, but there's also, like, Overwatch.
Oh, I know. There's so much Overwatch
and
to play.
And you have Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
I
have to go wander in the street and hit by a car trying to catch a Charmander.
Find dead bodies.
Yep.
I'm hooked on
yeah.
a bunch
of
pointless shit
adventures.
I bought on the Steam sale. We have busy lives.
Once I figure that out, then I'll definitely get the website.
Oh.
Then I'll definitely start pumping out some content.
Then finally we'll leave a legacy for our children to
work. We're the horrible people who are ignoring the apocalypse because we're just confident things that don't ask anything
else. So you guys, when Nick stares you in the face and asks why it happened, you can blame us.
Yep. Oh.
We ate that chocolate eclair.
It was so good.
Gobbled it down.
Yep.
I think we can put a lid on this. So we're gonna buy it out. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks with a mini episode.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
It's good every time.
I don't know how lucky Kim is.